Half Price Horror.
Hello and welcome to Half Price Horror, where we get our terror at a discount and pass the savings on to you. Half Price Horror is a spoiler-heavy podcast that takes a deep dive into scary movies curated by the selection at the local Half Price bookstore. I'm your host, John, and today we'll be taking a look at Pontypool from 2008. Written by Tony Burgess, not to be confused with Anthony Burgess, and directed by Bruce MacDonald. Burgess adapted the film from his own novel called Pontypool Changes Everything, which was released back in 1998, although some sources say 1995, which was when Burgess graduated from college with a degree in semiotics. And that's as good a place as any to start, because the field of semiotics is absolutely integral to the core concept of Pontypool, and I think we'll all get a lot out of a quick explanation of it before we begin. Semiotics is a field of study regarding the human mind's construction and communication of meaning through what's known as signs. Not signs in the conventional sense of the word, like street signs, although that kind of sign is a semiotic sign as well. A semiotic sign is anything that communicates a meaning to an interpreter. This can be as simple as a set of words, like what I'm using right now to talk to you about semiotics, or it can be visual symbols like color coding, auditory like a fire alarm, or even something scent-based like the understanding you receive when you smell breakfast cooking that you're not the only person awake in the house. The concept of a sign is pretty broad and all-encompassing, and it's no real surprise that there are a lot of subfields to this study. But one of the key and central concepts of semiotics is that there's no inherent and integral meaning to a sign. The sound mother doesn't have any intrinsic meaning, and you can prove this by studying languages that don't have a common root and noticing that mother in English is okasan in Japanese. If there was some characteristic the sound described, you'd see a fundamental similarity, but even the way we describe animal noises don't translate from language to language. So meaning is culturally constructed. It's something you learn from communicating with people. But, and this is the key, it's not simply mimicry either. When we communicate, we're not just repeating things that we know and understand, we're constructing new meanings using those signs, and in fact there's an entire field of study related to how we develop new signs based on our experiences in order to allow us to comprehend concepts outside of our existing mental vocabulary. A simple example, once the internet came into common cultural parlance, we needed a new way to describe this field of communication, and mail, an already familiar concept, became electronic mail, or email. Once e became a prefix to describe something that existed on the internet, people were free to consider e-commerce, e-business, or e-banking, and so on. Burgess emerged from his college career with a fascination with language, semiotics, and how the two are related in terms of the construction and communication of meaning, and sat down to write a novel about people who became infected with a word that obliterates all other words except itself in the mind of the victim. Unable to meaningfully communicate any longer due to their singular obsession, they become cannibalistically violent and attack everyone they see. The infected words spread through speech, so modern communication technology becomes the vector of the epidemic. I have read Pontypool Changes Everything. It is dense and frankly impenetrable, and I say this as someone with a lit degree myself. Burgess himself has commented on how difficult it is to read for anyone without a background in semiotics, so I don't think I'm being unfair here. Eventually, the book came to the attention of iconoclastic Canadian filmmaker Bruce MacDonald, who is known for making quirky independent movies like the mockumentary Hardcore Logo and the experimental deconstruction of narrative The Tracy Fragments. He got Burgess to adapt his novel simultaneously as a radio play and a movie, cutting down the unwieldy cast and sprawling setting to a single location and a handful of characters, and updating it to reflect developments since the 90s when the book was written. And by developments, I mean 9/11 and the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan, which were pretty much dominating the cultural and political conversation for most of the 8-year span of the George W. Bush administration and a little bit beyond. It feels odd to need to recap such a momentous historical event, but there are people out there old enough to drink now who weren't born when 9/11 happened. So, to sum it up quickly, a group of radical Islamic militants known as Al-Qaeda, who were convinced that the United States was using its cultural dominance to undermine the Muslim faith, became convinced that the only way to stop this was to draw America into a long-term war that would drain its coffers and make it look ineffectual in the eyes of the world. Most of the founders of Al-Qaeda were veterans of the Soviet-Afghan War, which used this tactic to great effect against the Soviet Union. After spending most of the 90s on terrorist attacks of increasing severity and frequency, Al-Qaeda struck on September 11, 2001, at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon by commandeering civilian jetliners and ramming the buildings. Almost 3,000 people died, and more importantly, the attacks had the desired effect. President George W. Bush was goaded into occupying both Afghanistan and Iraq, who had no involvement in the attacks but whose leader, Saddam Hussein, was already on Bush Jr.'s hit list because of a personal vendetta between Hussein and the Bush family. It is so hard to look back and realize just how many lives were lost over what was essentially a petty personal grudge. By the time Pontypool came out in 2008, both wars had been dragging on for several years, and it was clear to everyone in both the US and Canada that their respective governments were attempting to stage manage any and all news regarding the occupations in order to sanitize a long, bloody, messy war that we were all promised would be quick, tidy, and victorious. But people were also constantly afraid of reprisals from the terrorist organizations we were fighting, leading to a convoluted state of paranoia where we were looking for protection to people we did not and could not trust. Pontypool is absolutely steeped in that complex, post-traumatic threat response in ways we'll examine as the movie progresses. Oh, and speaking of that movie, yes, we are getting to it, I promise. It stars Stephen McCaddy as shock talk DJ Grant Mazzie. McCaddy is a character actor who's been working ever since the 1970s, popping up in episodes of everything from Kojak, to Starsky and Hutch, to Tales from the Dark Side, to Star Trek DS9, to Highlander, to Seinfeld, to Kung Fu the Legend Continues, to Hill Street Blues, to Law and Order, to Beauty and the Beast, to LA Law, to Quantum Leap, to The X-Files, to Walker Texas Ranger, to Birds of Prey, to Haven, to The Strain, to Orphan Black, to basically this dude is a narrative spine of genre television over the last 50 years. Oh, and if you remember Zack Snyder's Watchmen adaptation, he was Hollis Mason, the original Night Owl. Plus, he was in the 2019 movie Dreamland. We'll come back to that at the end. Compared to that, it's almost unfair to go to Lisa Howell, who plays station manager Sydney Breyer. Howell, who is McCaddy's real-life wife, has definitely got a few credits of her own on TV shows like Scene of the Crime and Cold Squad and Emily of New Moon. But a lot of her work seems to be opposite her husband, whether in Haven or Dreamland or this movie, and she appears to be content to leave the hard and relentless work of hustling for parts to him. Georgina Riley, who plays poor doomed Laurel Ann Drummond, considers this movie to be her big break. She had a few very small roles beforehand, but this led to a number of appearances in film and television, and finally an almost 70-episode stint as Dr. Emily Grace on the TV show Murdoch Mysteries. More recently, she followed it up with a season-long stint on the rebooted Quantum Leap as Janice Calavici. Playing Dr. Mendez, meanwhile, is Haran Alyanak, an Armenian-Canadian playwright and director who's also got over 100 roles in film and television to his credit. Like McCaddy, he's done a lot of genre television. It's been a while since I've mentioned this, but a lot of the syndicated genre shows that were so big in the 90s and 2000s filmed in Canada to take advantage of the exchange rate and the generous tax credits, but they had to have a certain percentage of the cast and crew come from the local talent pool to qualify. So if you were making Kung Fu the Legend Continues, RoboCop, Tech War, Tech Justice, Friday the 13th the series, or Earth Final Conflict, to give a few relevant examples, you'd bring in someone talented and reliable like Alyanak for your one-off appearances and get your production budget squared away that way. Looking at his IMDb page, he was definitely in great demand from those kinds of shows. Rick Roberts, who has a small but crucial voice role as Ken Loney in The Sunshine Chopper, didn't do many of those syndicated shows. He did, however, do a lot of Canadian film and television over the years, including long stints on Traitors and LA Doctors and guest appearances on Street Legal, Murdoch Mysteries, and Degrassi, The Next Generation. And speaking of voice work, Daniel Fathers, who is only heard as BBC News correspondent Nigel Healing, is very near and dear to fans of this podcast. He was the unnamed father in 2016's The Void, one of the very finest films I've covered, as well as The Dark Tower and the controversial Duncan Jones movie Mute. All in all, this is a densely packed cast that really takes advantage of the deep local talent pool in Toronto. Which is good, because this isn't exactly what you'd call a feast of visual spectacle. In fact, the cold open, which is a little monologue from Grant Mazzie to his listening audience about the odd coincidences surrounding the sudden appearance of Honey the Missing Cat, they all involve plays on the word Pontypool, and give you a good idea of the kind of playfulness with language that's Burgess's trademark, is visually represented simply by a line across the center of the screen that vibrates in time with McHattie's speech. At one point, they plan to use much more of this effect rather than show the actors, but wiser heads prevailed. It is very interesting to listen to this monologue a second time after seeing the movie in its entirety, because this is supposedly a pre-recorded segment playing over the radio as Mazzie's arrival at work, station CLSY 660, The Beacon, is delayed by a blizzard in the small Ontario town of Pontypool, which is a real place, albeit one nothing like what's shown here. And while we're never told what causes the sudden and spontaneous plague of infective language that devastates the region, we are told that it's important to avoid terms of endearment. So the fact that he's spreading the word honey to the entire listening audience may be a subtle hint that Grant was patient zero in all of this to begin with. We then fade into the title, one letter at a time, so it's at one point apparently called Typo, before fading back out to Mazzie as he drives through the dark and snow to the radio station while arguing with his agent. Mazzie, whose appearance is rangy and weathered and gaunt and suggests some kind of spectral cowboy doomed to ride the range for all eternity, is incredibly pissed off that he's stuck doing local news and traffic for a tiny regional Canadian station in the middle of nowhere, and it's clear that he's used to a much bigger audience that loves his shock jock antics and take no prisoners attitude. And catchphrase, as we'll see. This would all have been a very clear and very specific reference to audiences of the time. Don Imus, a radio talk show host who'd been on the air in various big market cities and syndication ever since the late 1960s, despite a history of erratic behavior and controversial comments, was finally fired from CBS Radio in 2007 for a series of racist remarks he made about the Rutgers women's basketball team. He was able to find another job fairly quickly, but it didn't have anything like the prestige or reach of his old position, and this is meant to be a satirical exaggeration of his fall from grace. After hanging up on his agent and throwing his phone across the car in a petulant temper tantrum, Grant hears it ringing again as he pulls up to a stop sign. As he's fumbling around for it, a woman walks up to the car and slaps her hand against the passenger window, repeating a single word over and over again before retreating into the snowy darkness. It's difficult to make out with the window blocking the sound, but it appears she may be saying, "Blood." Always a good start to the day. Grant finishes the drive-in, listening to his own pre-recorded voice through the loudspeakers in the parking lot as he enters the building, before he goes in to chat with his producer Sidney Breyer and sneak some scotch from his radio technician Laurel Ann for him to pour into his morning coffee. He then starts on his radio patter, introducing both women and mentioning that Laurel Ann is a veteran of Afghanistan, but Sidney's quick to point out that Pontypool is a small town where everyone but him already knows each other, and he's not telling his audience anything they're not already aware of. She was even honored as the homecoming hero at the last city fair. It's clear that the controversial attitude he brought to the big city doesn't really work in a small market, where every little grudge and slight and comment has to be lived with for decades, and the people you talk about on the air are going to be the people you meet on the street later that day. Grant then goes to the weather, which he describes as a big, cold, dull, dark, white, empty, never-ending, blow-my-brains-out, seasonal affective disorder, freaking kill-me-now weather front that'll last all day. Just to give you a little bit of a mental picture of his particular radio hosting style, and gets a report on weather and traffic from Ken Loney in the Sunshine Chopper. He banters with Ken about the risks of flying a helicopter in the storm, and McHattie makes some slightly odd performance choices here. His tone and facial expression are slightly skeptical, like he doesn't really believe Ken. But later on, when he finds out that Ken is actually sitting in a parked car on a scenic overlook, he's genuinely surprised and even a little bit crestfallen. Sorry, spoilers. So I'm not quite sure what's happening here from a performance standpoint, but everything McHattie does is so interesting in this movie, he's hard not to watch. Mazzy then gives a news update, discussing a bust of a suburban marijuana growing operation, then digresses off into a weird fear-mongering rant about drug lords turning family homes into death traps with anti-personnel mines and trained attack dogs, which is totally unsupported by fact and guaranteed to make people upset and unhappy. Starting with Sydney, who lays into him for doing his big city shock jock shtick when she needs someone who can do the school closure notices and read the ad copy when he's supposed to. Mazzy explains that he pisses people off in order to build engagement. Pissed off people might hate him, but they'll tune in every day to see what's going to make them angry next. Which is pretty much the underlying philosophy to YouTube, Twitter, and practically every single algorithm-driven social media site in existence right now, but it's kind of spooky hearing someone say it during a period when those sites were very much in their infancy. Now this is all starting to feel like the beginning of a Hallmark movie, with Grant learning how to embrace small-town positivity and woo his divorced producer, but after Grant describes his odd morning interaction with the woman outside the car, a call comes in on the police radio describing a hostage situation. Laurel feeds it to Grant, who announces it live on the air, but when Sydney tells him to downplay it until they can verify the report, he turns it into a joke about drunken cops holding guns on drunken ice fishermen. That doesn't go over well with Sydney, who knows full well that police officers Bob Roseland and Derek McCormick are in fact alcoholics struggling to keep their job, and she's going to have to deal with the fallout from Grant's casual slander. But just then, Ken Loney calls in from the Sunshine Chopper again. Only, as mentioned, he's not in a helicopter. He's in a Dodge Dart, playing little whoop-whoop-whoop sound effects as he reports the traffic, and everyone knows it but Grant. Sydney explains that Grant has walked into a small town with lifetimes of stories and complex networks of relationships among each and every inhabitant, and if he keeps stumbling through quote-unquote taking no prisoners and kicking over all these beehives, he's going to lose the only job he can still get. That last part is implied, of course. They're going to drop the hostage story, which seems to have resolved itself anyway as the apparently drunken ice fisherman fled off into the blizzard, and get on with cheering people up. But then Cadenloney calls in again, well ahead of schedule, and the movie takes a sharp lurch into horror. He goes live on the air with Grant to report an apparent riot at the offices of Dr. John Mendez, a local medical professional with a somewhat sketchy past, with hundreds of people gathering to force their way into the building and trampling each other in their haste. The wall literally breaks outward under the pressure, and military vehicles arrive with suspicious haste to contain the situation. Ken is, shall we say, not prepared to deal with this, and his mask of composure slips several times as he describes the horrific scene. And this, by the way, is why you get Stephen McHattie for this movie. So much of Pontypool is just close-ups of his face as he listens to people describe horrible things to him over the phone, or talks to an audience we never actually see, and if you didn't have an incredibly skilled and charismatic character actor in this role, it would be obvious just how limited the production really is in its ability to depict the situation. Even though obviously Burgess helps things along tremendously with his vivid and evocative dialogue. But because McHattie acts so convincingly like he believes it, we believe it as well, turning this very small production into a terrifying portrait of a region dissolving into chaos. Ken's call drops, and Grant suddenly snaps into big city professional radio host mode as he recaps the situation. Sydney and Laurel Ann then cut to an ad break while they tell Grant they don't have any confirmation of anything Ken was saying just yet, and they need Grant to stall for a little bit by interviewing the cast of the community theater production of Lawrence of Arabia as scheduled so they can get more information. Grant is less than thrilled about having to go back to bland, boring local interest material in the middle of an apparent riot happening just 5 kilometers away. That's about 3 miles for us Americans. And it doesn't help that this updated Lawrence of Arabia has been produced with all the tact and sensitivity you might expect from a community of extremely rural, extremely white Canadians during a war against Muslim terrorists. There is actual brown face here, I gotta warn you. And while I think it's obviously intended to be a satire of the kind of people who would think it was okay to wear it, it's still pretty uncomfortable. The cast comes in and sings a little song, because this is a musical version of Lawrence of Arabia. And by the way, the main singer is Tony Burgess himself, making a cameo as he sings alongside Osama bin Laden, because this is also apparently a production that decided to be a little quote-unquote experimental by adding bin Laden to the story, even though he wasn't born until 22 years after Thomas Lawrence died, and oh wow, is there a Waiting for Guffman-style comedy about this disaster piece just waiting to happen. As they finish, though, one of the girls, played by Hannah Fleming, confesses that she can't remember the end of the song, and then begins repeating the nonsense syllable pra, 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 over and over. The others escort her out, and Grant gets back to the news story in progress. Incidentally, I will bring this up once and only once, because I understand that this is supposed to be a chilling horror story first, and a realistic depiction of radio broadcasting about 84th, but dear God, does everyone treat the microphones in this movie like magic wands that only pick up the sounds they want people to hear. There's folks opening and closing the door to the radio booth while the mic is live. Grant is carrying on a conversation with his agent in the room and using profanity while the cast is singing just feet away. And basically, the audio for this show has to be just terrible for any radio listeners out there. There, got it out of my system. Now back to the movie. Calls begin to come in about the riot, and while they're ominously dropping almost as fast as they come in, they do begin to paint a picture of a bizarre and terrifying incident of mob violence that's spreading uncontrollably. The perpetrators of the violence are babbling, repeating and imitating sounds seemingly at random, and at least 75 people are already dead. Without any official information coming out about the story, Grant finds out that he is the best source of information in the entire world about the crisis when Nigel Healing of the BBC calls in to interview him live on air. Nigel seems to think this is all a terrorist insurgency, possibly something related to Quebecois separatists, because this was 2008 and everyone was still tensed up and waiting for another 9/11 on North American soil. Grant tries to calm down the rumors by pointing out that there have been no demands and no political targets involved, but unfortunately he doesn't know what actually is happening, even though he knows what isn't. The BBC cuts away as we get another call from Ken, and the situation in the Sunshine Chopper isn't good. In the sense that he's been forced to abandon his Dodge Dart, pursued by a babbling mob, and hide in a grain silo. I've seen things today that are gonna ruin the rest of my natural life, Grant, he says, explaining that the group is cannibalistic and uncontrollably violent. Even as he watches from his hiding place, rioters pull two people out of a van and bite into their flesh like a school of piranha. And although Sidney tells Grant to cut off the interview after that, it's hard to reassert control in the face of Ken's vivid and terrifying description of these stark horrors. One of the rioters, who are called conversationalists in the screenplay but never in the actual film, comes crashing through the wall, injuring himself so badly in the process he can no longer move, and Ken decides to get a little closer to examine them because the person is still trying to speak. We don't find out what happens, yet, because the signal is overridden by some kind of emergency message in French and the call is dropped. Laurel Ann translates it and Grant reads it out. For your safety, please avoid contact with close family members and restrain from the following. All terms of endearment, such as honey or sweetheart, baby talk with young children, and rhetorical discourse. For greater safety, please avoid the English language. Please do not translate this message. I love that little thrill of dread you get on hearing that last sentence. It reminds me a lot of the spookier moments in Welcome to Night Vale, another story about a local radio station where something very strange is going on. The police inform Sydney that the town is under quarantine and there's a shelter-in-place order being enforced, which hits very different now than it did in 2008, and Ken calls back to play the audio recording he made from the conversationalist he approached. The teenage boy is crying out, "Mommy, help me," in the voice of a small infant. And that's just about the breaking point for Grant. With nothing to rely on but the voices in his ear, he's beginning to wonder if any of this is real or if the inhabitants of Pontypool are pulling a War of the Worlds-style radio prank on him. Laurel Ann goes to a pre-recorded list of school closures as Grant has a nervous breakdown in real time. He decides to go out and look outside for himself, to feel the wind on his face and connect back with some kind of reality, and Laurel Ann puts the Honey the Cat tape back on to keep the station from playing dead air. Again, given that terms of endearment may be the cause of everything, it seems highly suspicious that Laurel Ann plays Honey the Cat right before she becomes infected herself. The three of them go out into the snow, and this is a real triumph of low-budget ingenuity as Laurel Ann reacts to something off-screen and pulls the others back inside before we have to show any expensive crowds or potentially budget-busting scenes of devastation. She tells Grant they have an enemy outside, Freudian slipping a sir at the end as a sign that she may be drifting into PTSD just a touch, and we hear multiple voices repeating Grant and Sydney's own words back to them as hands begin to slap at the doors and windows. Whatever's going on, it's very real, and it's right outside now. Grant goes back on the radio, snapped back into professionalism, and reads out the obituaries. They're a little unrealistic under the circumstances, but there's a dark and twisted humor to the way he reads out the death notices of all the confirmed fatalities for that morning over black and white footage of the many, many dead. I find it a little bit difficult to believe that they would be able to get all this information on such short notice, but still, I'd probably have just as much trouble resisting this gag as Burgess did. While he's on the air, Laurel Ann helps bandage up a cut Sydney sustained earlier, but as she talks, she begins to develop a vocal tic centered around the words, Mr. Mazzy's missing. It eventually devolves into repeating the word missing over and over again. And although she's initially able to say other things with great effort, she soon loses all speech except that single solitary word. She wanders away as the kettle in the kitchen begins whistling, and there's a glorious moment of stark, surreal terror when Sydney removes it from the hot plate only to discover that Laurel Ann is now flawlessly imitating the sound. Just then, Dr. Mendez comes crawling in through a window he jimmied open, and on seeing Laurel Ann, he immediately tells Sydney they need to get away from her as far and as fast as possible. He sees the soundproof booth and ushers them both inside, sharing his observations from the morning so far as they apply to the rapidly deteriorating Laurel Ann. Apparently, the virus affecting her is causing her to seek out people to attack, and she runs repeatedly into the window to the booth trying to get at them. If I have a single complaint about this movie, it's that we never do get an especially clear explanation from Mendez about what he knows and why he knows it. He points to specific behaviors from Laurel Ann, saying, oh yes, I knew she was going to do this, but this is a good spot for an info dump in a movie that's more complex than your average zombie apocalypse, and instead Mendez turns out to be a lot less useful than we might have hoped for. Then again, maybe that's the point. Maybe he isn't an expert, just a medical doctor in the wrong place in the wrong time who's doing his best to find explanations for an unprecedented and possibly impossible phenomenon. Ken Loney calls in again, still alive and still hiding in the grain silo, but as he talks he begins to confuse the word symbol with symptom and sample before he eventually settles on simple. Once he begins to repeat simple, he can't stop, and eventually Grant disconnects the call on realizing that Ken's consciousness isn't really there anymore. Sydney breaks down in tears as she realizes the man she worked with for 17 years has simply vanished over live radio, and even though she hated him and made sure her kids were never alone with him, she still knew him for so long that she can't quite come to terms with her emotions. She then realizes she just called the dead man a pedophile over an open mic and clams up. Laurel Ann's been just outside the booth the entire time, alternating between running headlong into the glass and looking for another target to vent her virus-induced cannibalistic urges onto, and as she returns to the glass, we see that she's gnawed off her own lower lip. Dr. Mendez theorizes that the virus is transmitted through language, infecting certain words and phrases that colonize the brain as soon as the contaminated word is understood. Not heard, mind you, but understood and conceptualized. This may be why certain people seem to be immune for a time, is that if they're not paying attention, they're not really trying to understand the word, so just zoning out at the right place at the right time could save your life. The conversationalist then develops uncontrollable cannibalistic urges, and if they're unable to fulfill them, like Laurel Ann, well, It doesn't take us long to find out. She slams herself repeatedly against the window while the station goes to Muzak, and Sydney talks to her children for what might be the final time. And then as the virus enters its final stages, Laurelan vomits out a torrent of blood and collapses, dead. The conversationalists need to communicate, whether that's with others of their kind or through violence against the uninfected, and when they're isolated, the symbiotic virus eats through its host to devastating and fatal effect. Just then, a horde of conversationalists break into the station, all of them slapping at the glass and seeking to break into the booth, and Mendez's advice to the others to keep focusing on their breathing and stay calm is not going to help under the circumstances. They turn off the lights in the booth and lie low under the desk, communicating by writing notes to each other in the shadows, and come up with a dual plan. First, to use the loudspeakers in the parking lot to lure the conversationalists outside with the sound of a human voice, and second, to send out an SOS to anyone monitoring the situation by looping the phrase, "Sydney Brier is alive." Because the conversationalists repeat sounds they hear, anything they hear will travel within earshot of the ever-growing mob and signal the authorities as to their whereabouts. The plan works, surprisingly enough, and the conversationalists all file back out into the parking lot. But it's about here that it becomes obvious that Mendez isn't just repeating "breathe" as advice, he's actually infected as well. He halts the progress of the disease by switching into Armenian, but none of the others understand Armenian, so he can't communicate with them. Only English is unsafe, but even though Sydney is bilingual, as are many Canadians, Grant's American and doesn't speak more than a word or two of French. That's enough to convey the idea that they should ditch Mendez and find somewhere else to hole up, though. They go upstairs to the front desk, only to find the little girl from Lawrence of Arabia waiting for them. Grant and Sydney are forced to kick her to death, something that obviously weighs heavily on Sydney given her own children, who are safe with their dad over 60 miles away, and the two of them have a tense, urgent conversation about it that's somewhat complicated by Sydney's inability to remember the French word for kill. She's forced to use English for that word, something that will come back to haunt her very soon. Unfortunately, time runs out for them when the power to the station is interrupted, ending "Sydney Brier is alive" and replacing it with a much less distracting French rendition of "O Canada," which the subtitles insist is "La Marseillaise." I don't know how you mix those two up. The conversationalists come pouring back inside, pursuing Mendez as he tries to rejoin the duo, and they take refuge in the same supply room that Mendez came in through. He exits through the window exactly as he arrived, and Sydney and Grant barricade the door to keep themselves safe. The open window is, weirdly enough, ignored both by Grant and Sydney as a means of escape and by the conversationalists as a means of access. I guess there's a "For Mendez's Only" sign on it or something. I'd suggest that maybe Sydney and Grant didn't want to go out into the blizzard without winter coats, but that would raise the question of why none of the conversationalists are freezing to death out there in the middle of the Ontario winter, dressed in whatever they happened to be wearing when they got infected, and believe me, I don't think we want to start pulling on that thread. But if we did, I would point to this as a common fault in any of the "they're alive but infected with a disease that makes them act like zombies" subgenre of zombie movies. Willpower is certainly a wonderful thing, and it can propel us to amazing feats when necessary, but it's not actually a substitute for things like blood pressure and warm clothing. The laws of thermodynamics do not ignore zombies, and all of these movies act like they do simply because it's necessary to the story. We jump ahead some time, certainly long enough for Sydney to have covered the door with apologies for killing the little girl, and to have drunk most of Grant's scotch to boot. One of my favorite lines in the whole movie: "We're not talking, I'm drunk. This is exactly how my last relationship ended." She's so obsessed with the death that when she begins ranting at Grant about it, we don't immediately notice at first how obsessed she is with the word "kill." But Grant's brainstorming a solution to their problem even as her speech deteriorates, realizing that if it's understanding that causes the virus to take root, you can destroy it by making the word incomprehensible. That's why people keep repeating the infected words. They're not transmitting the virus, they're trying to render that word into meaningless sound through repetition, something I think everyone's experienced at some point. But because it doesn't seem to be working, Grant suggests instead trying to rewire the meaning of the word instead. So as Sydney descends into rote repetition, saying "kill" again and again, Grant repeats to her that "kill" means "kiss" instead. Confusing the meaning of the word confuses Sydney's understanding of it, and when she tells him to kill her, they instead embrace in a romantic moment that's somehow utterly unconvincing despite the fact that these two people are real-life husband and wife and have children together. I just think the antagonism between them was set up too well and developed too long to suddenly swerve into a third-act romance like this 12 minutes before the end of the movie, but that could just be me. Incidentally, the radio version of this takes the opposite tack to much bleaker effect. Instead of miraculously curing Sydney, the verbal misdirection only causes a momentary remission, and she asks him to kiss her, knowing full well what she truly means. He mercifully ends her suffering, then broadcasts the obits of Sydney, Laura Lann, and the infected Mendez before finding his own infected word, paper, as the play ends. But this is the movie, and they've just found their miracle cure. They race down to the radio booth, trying to broadcast mass confusion and annihilate understanding in their infected listening audience. This is the most deep-dive semiotics-based conclusion any horror movie is ever going to have. But the government is outside killing the mob, and they inform Sydney they'll bomb the radio station if they continue talking. This is where we get the slogan to the movie, as Sydney says to Grant, "It's shut up or die." Grant points out that the military is nothing more than a bunch of scared people committing genocide to keep their tenuous grip on power, because this is 2008 and everyone had the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan on their mind, and keep in mind this was made before Obama was elected, when it felt very much like the Republican administrations and the war would both continue indefinitely. I feel like this is a big shift to topical anti-war messaging in the literal last minutes of a movie that has up until now been about semiotics and linguistics, but it's hard to argue that it's a bad message to send, and Stephen McCaddy really lets it roll off the tongue with that wonderfully mellifluous voice of his. And speaking of just minutes left, the government responds to his impassioned monologue with a French countdown from 10 to 1 and the sound of approaching explosions, and it's clear that they've decided to deal with the problem the same way they deal with everything else, by carpet bombing it to oblivion. The screen cuts to black as the countdown ends, because this isn't a movie that has the budget for an explosion, and as the end credits play, we hear various news reporters trying to summarize the tragedy. It sounds like another epidemic is beginning in Petersboro, though, and the last voice is that of Nigel Healing, saying that the police have successfully contained the rioting in Pontypool. 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 It's a great note to close out on, but these are some very experimental filmmakers, and so we get a bizarre, surreal black-and-white post-credit sequence where Grant and Sydney sit at what appears to be a Japanese sake bar, with Sydney wearing a dress that appears to be East Asian inspired, talking about changing their names and identities and going on the run. The film slowly develops into color as they call themselves Johnny Deadeyes and Lisa the Killer, planning to go somewhere that doesn't even exist yet and start a crime spree together. Lisa almost calls Grant baby as she agrees, but he shushes her in a final nod to the movie we just watched. And weirdly, McDonald and Burgess collaborated on a movie in 2019 called Dreamland, where McCaddy plays a jazz musician who becomes the target of a hitman named Johnny Deadeyes, also played by McCaddy. And yes, Lisa Howell is in the movie, and yes, she does play Lisa the Killer. So I guess it's intended to be a weird spiritual sequel to the post-credits scene to Pontypool? It's probably the only sequel we're going to get, as the release dates for Pontypool Changes have slipped from 2010 to 2013 to 2019 to be determined. And I'm okay with that, honestly, because this is one of those experimental and strange little movies that maybe doesn't need a sequel. It's exactly what it needs to be. Even if, yes, I do wonder where the story goes from here. And will I hang on to this movie? Oh, absolutely. This is a lovely example of how to do an imaginative, interesting, intense horror movie on almost no budget. I can't say I really like Grant Massey, but I'm interested in finding out what happens to him as the day unfolds, and the tiny little touches of the surreal make for an immersive viewing experience. I would have covered this one even without the prompting of my buddy Boomer over at Podcast in the Woods, and I hope you're all listening to that show too. They're just immensely sweet folks who love horror from the sublime to the schlocky, just like me. But I'm glad he made me move it up on the lists. And if you want to talk about terms of endearment, such as honey or sweetheart, baby talk with young children, rhetorical discourse, or about anything else that came up on this podcast, you can find me on Twitter as @halfhorror, and on Tumblr, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd as Half Price Horror. My watch list on Letterboxd contains everything I plan to tackle in future episodes. If there's something you'd like to hear about, let me know. You can also support the show at patreon.com/halfpricehorror, and you can rate and review me on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else this podcast is found. And next time on Half Price Horror, I really wasn't sure if I wanted to take on another horror franchise so soon after finishing up with Evil Dead in the Summer of Sam. It was a lengthy ride, probably one of the longer franchises I'm going to cover on this podcast, and the lack of counter-programming between installments was a tiny bit exhausting. But I've got the discs for another full series run all lined up, and honestly, how can I tackle Michael and Jason and leave out Freddy Krueger? So brew up a nice big pot of chamomile tea, take a melatonin gummy, and get cozy under the covers as we take on Wes Craven's original, A Nightmare on Elm Street. See you then.